Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
And Marcus Rashford's been the most convincing, empathetic political voice in my country over the last 15, 18 months.
Welcome all, it's episode 74 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is journalist and author Michael Calvin. Michael is one of the most accomplished sports writers in the UK. He has covered pretty much every major sporting event there is to cover, including 7 Olympic Games and 6 World Cups. He has twice been named Sports Writer of the Year and on 2 further occasions won the Sports Reporter of the Year award. He's authored numerous award-winning books as well, including The Nowhere Men, Living on the Volcano, and No Hunger in Paradise. And he's also co-written the autobiographies of Alistair Cook, Dylan Hartley, Joey Barton, and, as you're about to hear, Gareth Thomas. His latest book is called Whose Game Is It Anyway? Football, Life, Love and Loss, and it's out now. So let's get on with the show. Michael Calvin, thanks so much for doing the podcast.
That's a pleasure.
So your new book, Whose Game Is It Anyway, is out now. It's more personal, Michael, than many of the books that you've written before. So can you maybe tell us why you wrote it?
Well, it was written at the height of the pandemic. And I suppose over the last year or so, it's been a time for all of us for self-reflection and almost a quiet search for meaning. Now, that's been conducted, you know, for most of us in private. But it was the death of my father-in-law prompted it from COVID. And almost the last few days of his life where he had also had accelerated vascular dementia. So there was one moment where about 4 days before he passed where he had a sudden moment of clarity, and he spoke of being a 10, 11-year-old boy walking to a game on a Saturday and what it meant to him, the sweet shop and the anticipation of the game, the sights and the sounds and the smells of a football match. And, you know, I suppose anyone, you know, we've all been introduced to the game as kids. We can all identify with that sense of scale. And it is a sort of multi-sensual experience in many ways, football. And I'd fallen out of love with the game and what it represented and the whole hyper-commercialization and the innate cynicism of it, which we've obviously seen in the Super League proposals. I suppose this book was my way of trying to rediscover my love for the game and what it meant to me as a kid. So obviously that meant I had to go through my own life and times. And, you know, obviously I've been really blessed in terms of, you know, journalism or sports writing in particular. It's taken me, you know, all over the place, more than 80 odd countries over far too many years. But, and I've always valued the platform that sports writing can give one, and also the ability it offers to actually just have a little nibble around the edges of the human condition. Because I did sports, I lucked into sports writing simply because I really wanted to have a platform which enabled me to look at the best of human nature, which you do see in sport, but also the worst, which you do see.
How did you find the process of writing it? Was it hard?
No, I'm a great believer, Gavin, in books almost writing themselves. You know, you can have an idea of the narrative arc of a book, but something happens or a thought pops up or an incident happens and it takes you off on another path, that's what I love about it, to be honest. It's that sort of, you're on a, whenever you sit down, you know, there's that moment of absolute existential terror when you're actually sitting in front of a blank screen and you write chapter one or prologue or whatever it is. And, you know, at that time, you've probably got an idea in your head where it's going to go. But frankly, it very rarely ends up like that. I suppose this one was different for me because I knew, you know, the type of process that the book would entail, which is, you know, obviously, you know, being much more personal and looking at my own career. I was pretty nervous about it, to be honest, because, you know, as I said at the start, we do have a quite a prominent platform to look at, the human condition. But, you know, is it rocket science? Do we save lives as sports writers? No, of course we don't. And sometimes I did shy away from the idea of, oh yeah, well, here he is, another old hack knocking out his memoir. You know, I don't like that idea. And I don't think what we do is that important in the grand scheme of things. And I suppose that's also another element of the self-reflection that we've all done, you know, over the last sort of 15, 18 months or so. So that's why I've tried to combine this as a, you know, I describe it as a part memoir, part manifesto for football or for sport. And that's where I've tried to use my own experiences to draw broader conclusions about, you know, the nature of heroism, the societal issues that we're confronted by as we travel around the world in this, you know, great sort of sporting circus. And I suppose also I've been around long enough to be a witness, you know, to history. I know that sounds a bit portentous, but actually, you know, when you think about it, when I started off, my first Olympic Games was in Moscow, which was, you know, the height of the Cold War, the boycott led by the US at the time, where sport was being, was at that sort of, front line. Athletes were dragged into a sort of social, cultural and political front line there in that war. So then, you know, I was able to use my own sport's got an amazing power of access. And so certainly in the sort of in the 80s, you know, I was able to get into closed societies. You know, Albania at that time, just coming out of the, you know, one of the dictatorships, you know, one of the hidden sort of horrors of modern history, a guy called Enver Hoxha, who was the, you know, a hugely authoritarian figure there. I was smuggled in Albania under the guise of being Terry Venables' interpreter for Barcelona. You know, interviewing solidarity activists in Poland when Poland was under martial law and not allowing Western journalists in, you know, basically interviewing them in confessionals, which was a completely surreal experience where, you know, you play the role of penitent and we went into the Arch Cathedral in Warsaw on the pretext of covering a European under 21 championship football match. And to go into the confessional, on the other side of the grill where the priest usually sat was a solidarity activist who basically gave a chapter and verse what was going on. And that activist actually was set up by local journos. So there was this sort of, you know, international brotherhood of hackdom, if you like, took over there. So you know, those are experiences, you know, working in South Africa at the dying days of apartheid. And seeing, you know, the absolutely abhorrent system that was operating there, but also being there at a time of huge, where the tectonic plates were shifting, where, you know, Mandela was released when I was covering a rebel cricket tour, which collapsed because of the political dynamic which led to Mandela's release. You know, I met key ANC figures then, who were basically on the street activists who then were on the right side of history. So they actually became presidential advisors that enabled me to, you know, have the privilege of meeting Mandela in during the Rugby World Cup, went back for the Football World Cup. So you saw how football changed there. And, you know, frankly, I was lucky to be a sports writer at the Telegraph. I was chief sports writer from just after the 86 World Cup. And I had so much more scope, you know, these days, if a journo went to his sports editor, and in my case, it was a guy called David Welsh, who was a really innovative sports editor who produced the first ever sports supplement in Fleet Street. And I'm chief sports writer, so therefore I'm meant to be, you know, supposedly the main man, turn up the big events, all that sort of stuff. And I said, look, I want to do this around the world yacht race. I want to compete in it. And I need to go off diary for a year. And you like today, they'd have sent me to a drugs test if I'd have said that. But he, you know, he had the foresight to actually say, yeah, okay, let's go for it, you know? And you know, that, so that gave me an insight, you know, that was a life lesson of all life lessons to do that. And you know, that was at a time where I was doing all sorts of daft stuff. I, you know, did an off-road rally in the Amazon. So you see the Amazon basin for what it is, and you see deforestation, and it makes you more aware of huge social issues like climate change. So, you know, sport of a kind gives you access, but it also, you know, it's a huge teacher. It teaches you about people. It teaches you about the world. And that's what I've always tried to do is use my books as almost, to offer insight into the human condition, to it, because essentially, you know, because people, the book features, you know, people like Muhammad Ali and whom I met first as a kid, then saw him. I saw him 20 years later in 1990. And this was just after the world had seen him as he was via Parkinson's. And, you know, there were those indelible images of him at the Atlanta Olympics. People say, well, how can you relate to people like that? Well, you relate to them because they're like you. They're like you. Yeah, I mean, they're flesh and blood. Cut them and they bleed. They have their own private fears and stresses. And watching Ali, I was covering a Tyson fight, Mike Tyson fight, against a Polish pacifist called Andrew Galotta, who literally surrendered after two rounds. And Ali turned up, and was in a place called Auburn Hills, Michigan, and he was there to watch his daughter, who was heading the undercard. Well, I say to watch, and that's completely wrong, because he turns up, and, you know, as I describe in the book, whenever he went anywhere, there was a human earthquake. There were bodies flying all over the place. One of the joys in inverted commas of covering boxing is that you do get quite close to the ring, or you used to anyway. And, you know, you get blood and snot and God knows what else will have your notebook. But on the other side of the Ali settled on the other side of the ring to the press seats, and I couldn't take my eyes off him. It was just mesmerizing, because he just sat there, and the bell rang for the first round of his daughter's fight, and he just put his hands over his face like that, and they didn't move until the bell ended for that first round. And he had a white handkerchief where he mopped his brow. And that continued, that ritual continued throughout the fight. And it was a 6-round fight from memory. And it went to points. And he couldn't bear to see his daughter being punched. Now, that's a completely natural human reaction. You know, I've got a daughter. I couldn't watch either. In fact, I'll probably be in the ring, but it's like, this is who they are. You know, we talk about heroes and we invest them with so much significance, but ultimately you peel away the layers of the onion, they're just, you know, ordinary people. Well, not ordinary. They are ordinary people, but they have extraordinary talents and an extraordinary stage on which to flaunt those talents.
That empathy, which I think is the right word to describe what you're describing there, is probably what makes you such a good interviewer. Like when we were asking our listeners for questions for you, so many of them were related to living on a volcano, the book you did with various English football managers. Like, can you talk to us a little bit about, because there are some interviews in that book which are superb. I mean, the Brendan Rodgers one is the best Brendan Rodgers interview I've ever read, because, you know, he goes into his usual, what I would call kind of twee shtick about jogging around the streets of Liverpool and listening and smelling the mince cooking on people's hearts and so on. But then he says that, and then he gets to a point where he says, I've had to build up a brand about myself and my philosophy because I've never I've never had a big playing career. I was like, that's the first time I've ever seen the mask slip for Brendan Rodgers. So could you maybe talk to us about what makes a good interviewer?
Well, I think, you know, the E word is a very pertinent one. You know, empathy. You have to, there are some brilliant interviewers who are forensic and, you know, like you said at the start, when we talked about at the start about how a book goes, you know, there are some guys who have questions and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, you know, if this happens, that happens, I'm going to ask that question. I don't. One of the key things, and it's, you know, I hope I don't sound too pious about it, but is that you have to, you know, you can't compensate for research. You've got to drill into people before you even get to them. You just can't rock up and wing it. So get to know the person that you're interviewing before you even meet them as a starting point. But also, you know, it's an extension of what we talked about. You know, they're human beings. You know, they have the same emotions as you. You know, maybe they professionally disguise some of those emotions and want to suppress some of their character traits. But if you have a conversation with them, that's the key. The conversation is the key. It is putting someone at ease. I think also, you know, you can't underestimate the fact, and this is where I will probably sound pious and I apologize, but you can't underestimate the fact that sport in particular is a very, very small world. So if you're going to interview sportsman A, you can bet your bottom dollar he's spoken to sportsman B and C. Oh, I'm seeing this Calvin guy. What's he like? And if you've got a bad reputation, it was one of my sort of principal tutors in journalism, a guy called Reg Hayter. I worked for his agency in Fleet Street as a kid, as 18, 19 year old. I was ghostwriting Dennis Compton at 19, which was just, you know, it was sort of Hogwarts stuff, you know, going to interview ghosts. It was weird. But one thing that Reg said to me was, look, and it's very early on, he said, Calvin, he said, you've only got one reputation. Cherish it. So, you know, as I said, I've been around a long time. And the one thing that I've been religious about, and now again, as I say, this is sounding pious, but I've never broken a confidence. Never, ever. And I wouldn't. You see, you know, I've been around, you see guys come through and they've obviously got talent. But they go for the hit and they'll go for, they'll take one shortcut too many. So they're like, these guys are like comets. They come straight across the sky, but then they're gone for another 90 years. Whereas, you know, if you play fast and loose with people, it will bite you in the end. I try to operate in a spirit of mutual trust and respect. Now, in a strange way, and this is really unfair, because I think actually the pandemic brought home to me that we're living in a golden age of journalism, in sports writing anyway, where there's a lot of young guys and girls coming through who are writing with great empathy. There is a move to a much more analytical style of writing, you know, especially in football. You know, frankly, I'm about words, not numbers, but, you know, they're offering a different dimension. But the one thing that we can't get away from is that, you know, we're dealing with people here, you know, and I know I'm sounding, you know, like a broken record here, but it's a really important factor that, you know, you've got to like people. And also, but the unfair factor is, you know, I've been around in newspaper. I basically moved a lot. I moved out of newspapers sort of, well, when I was chief sports writer on the Independent on a Sunday, and when that sort of sank gently beneath the waves in about, what, 2015, 2016, I'd had an approach from, you know, the Sunday Times to do stuff for them, but I was more and more drawn towards full-time book writing. And also, you know, I'm fortunate that I've done three documentaries off the back of them for BT Sport, which I really enjoy doing. It's a different medium, obviously, but it's a different discipline writing for pictures and trying to almost editorialize over an issue. But it is, as I say, this is where the unfair bit comes in. So, and it was summed up, I was doing some stuff for a book I did called State of Play, where I was just looking at the big picture of football, modern football. And a friend of mine had got me into Barcelona, the football club, for a couple of two days. I had a run of the place, pretty much. He knew a guy called Pep Segura, who was the director of football at the time. And he'd been banging on to him, look, Mike wants, Mike's a good guy, you can trust him, blah, blah, blah. But he said, well, he's a journalist. We can't have a journalist running around here. And my friend said, well, no, he's not a journalist, he's an author. Oh, you should have said. Oh, okay, well, he's an author, he's okay. Now, so, that's bonkers. But because I'm a journalist, I just thought, I work in books, and and I love what I love about doing books is that, okay, in all the time that I spent, 30 years as either a chief sports writer or a columnist on national papers, the max length is usually between sort of 1,000, 1,200 words. But when you've got a book, you've got 100,000, and you can then really get deep into the issues or the personalities or the characters. And you discover things like nuance, and you give your subjects room to breathe, and also I think they feel they have room to breathe. They trust the process of a book, and this is where I suppose, I've got sort of like two strands of my writing in terms of I've got my own stuff. Such as Whose Game Is It Anyway? But also I've got my co-writes. So I've done four now with Gareth Thomas, Joey Barton, Alistair Cook and Dylan Hartley, the England rugby captain. And that's a different dynamic completely, because I'm having to go one step beyond in terms of absolutely trying to get inside those guys' heads and see what they see and feel what they feel and think how they work out how they think, and that's a really interesting process. I really enjoy that, but I equally enjoy doing my own stuff.
Just on the, that's so interesting what you said about journalist versus author.
It's mad, by the way, absolutely mad.
It's such a contradiction in the sense, like, newspapers will want their journalists to interview people and make them seem interesting and deep and so on, but at the same time some newspapers at least need a headline, and that strips the word that you mentioned, I think, is the operative one. It's nuance. So that's all stripped away. And in your book, I think that was probably best articulated through the treatment of England football managers. The great line is that Graham Taylor flew too close to the sun with the sun italicized. It is an impossible job, isn't it? And what you rightly point out, actually, is how harshly Sam Allardyce was treated. I haven't read much pity for Allardyce since he got the sack, but he was very unfairly dealt with, I think.
Yeah, I suppose he, to an degree, he was a victim of his own personality and also a victim of perception. And there was a bit of, rustling of the crinolines of, we've got Sam Allardyce as an England manager, why are we inviting a below the stairs man to do the job? The England manager's job, I don't think it's necessarily impossible, and also the media is changing. It'd be interesting to see how the Euros go for Gareth Southgate. Because of the Allardyce affair, if we can call it that, he obviously came in on a big white charger for the World Cup in Russia. And the one thing that he did do, and it was great PR, an unaccustomably good PR from the FA, but when we used to cover, England under Capello, Hodgson, it was camp paranoia. And, also there were the cliques, under Sven. I loved Sven. I liken Sven in the book to Harold Lloyd, the silent movie guy, where the house collapses all around him. And he's looking around thinking, well, what the hell's going on here? And just lorrips off into the sunset. There, it was just a basically unpleasant place to be, the England camp. But so Gareth sort of worked that out, and he basically, because he had a younger group, he was able, and he'd come through with them in a developmental sense. He was able to say, well, okay, let's try something different here. Let's welcome people in. And I've always found that, again, there has to be, that was a gesture of faith and trust in him, in his part. And there's almost a self-interest here because, a journo isn't going to, essentially crap on his own doorstep by abusing that access. So I think it's a sort of quite a subtle way of doing it. And he got really good press, Gareth. And I like him a lot. I like his attitude. He was actually, you mentioned Brendan Rodgers earlier on. I was chatting to him for another book, and he'd read Volcano. He said, "Mike," he said, "you didn't like Brendan Rodgers, did you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I really liked him. I thought he was great." He said, "Oh, well, the way you started that chapter and take the piss and all that." And I just sort of, I said, "Well, you said really where it's like," I said, "Look, he actually, I think he really, he's a really compelling guy. I think he's a really good coach. I get why he's a good coach." And it is interesting also where I saw Brendan recently. I did a sort of series of podcast series for BT on like me interviewing big managers. And right at the end of that, we did a, it was the sort of final sort of question. It was a pretty hackneyed question. I said, "But okay, Brendan, you've been through the Celtics experience, you've been through the Liverpool experience, you're here at Leicester now. I get what you're trying to do. What's been the great lesson of your career?" And he just looked at me very archly and said, "Well," I said, "I have learned," he said, "to say a little less and listen a little more." And he looked at me and sort of winked, and I thought, "Okay, yeah, I get you, mate. I get you." So that's really it's another indication that these blokes are pretty like you and me in many ways, But in terms of Gareth, I think he's at a stage now, expectation is the only, is always, hope and expectation is always the thing that kills an England manager. And he's got to produce this time around because there is a hackneyed phrase and it's been overused in the past. There is a golden generation of English talent coming through. When you think about, we're talking just after the Champions League semi-finals where you've had Phil Foden and Mason Mount, looking two of the best young players in the world. And we've got that, and probably he's got to build his team around those two guys. So it is interesting. Obviously within the book, I talk about the impact that the England job had on Graham Taylor, who was probably the first manager with whom I, came into contact, really. I was on the local paper in Watford very briefly. And he was a journalist's son, and one of the things that really came home to me during writing Whose Game Is It Anyway was the way our lives sort of follow the life cycles of the people we write about. So in Graham's case, as I said, he was the first manager. I saw how he galvanized the club, but more importantly, how he galvanized the community. And, there was ruthlessness there, but wow, he could get people on his side. And ultimately that led him into the England job. And this is where our job as writers, as sports writers, can get quite onerous in terms of you've got to be true to yourself, you've got to be true to your reader. And sometimes that's bloody uncomfortable because you're having to say really harsh things about someone that you admire and almost have developed a pretty you know, a pretty big relationship with, you know, on a personal level. So with Graham, you know, I was, there was that infamous press conference and the infamous documentary where, you know, frankly, I watched him there and he just had a meltdown, and it was, I had to go away and write a column basically saying the England job was too big for him. And I knew that would be, you know, because I knew his wife, Rita, I know his two daughters. I knew that would have a big effect, a bigger effect on him than maybe, you know, someone he didn't really know that well saying it. And it did affect our friendship to a degree, or our relationship. You know, you're never truly friends with your subjects, are you? But it taught me. It taught me a lot. Sometimes you've got to criticize, even though you don't want to sometimes. But you've got to do it. You've just got to follow. You've got to follow it. You know, and then, you know, to see his career towards the end. You know, he was, as I said, journalist's son. Tommy, his dad, was. He reported on Scunthorpe United from Second World War onwards to about 83, I think, from memory. And, you know, Graham as a kid was taken to the local paper where his dad worked. And he remembers like that sort of sweet smell of the ink that, you know, printer's ink and stuff like that. And, you know, I saw him later in his career. Obviously he was working, he was a very good commentator or co-commentator for the BBC. So you see him around the press box. You know, there were no airs and graces to him. He would take his turn and go and get the teas at half time and stuff like that. And that's why I wanted to do, there's a chapter in the book, you know, based around his funeral, but also it gave me a chance to try and assess how brutally he was treated. It was mm-hmm. really brutal. And you know, the son, Kelvin McKenzie, I thought that, you know, certain McKenzie, I thought, you know, I wrote in a book, I always felt that McKenzie, I still do, that was one of the most malign influences in British journalism, certainly in my lifetime. You know, the England job spat him out, Graham, but it didn't mean he's a bad man.
You mentioned the art of co-writing earlier on, and I know that is the subject of one of your picks, which is Paul McGrath's autobiography written with Vincent Hogan of the Irish Independent. Why did you pick it?
It taught me a lot about the art of co-writing. Vince and I go way back. Vince actually worked at Haters with me, you know, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, basically. And I've always admired Vince's writing. I've not had much experience of Gaelic sport, which is obviously a big part of his output. You know, I would see him around at, you know, the Masters and Ryder Cups and stuff like that. But I've admired him as a writer, and he's a super bloke as well. He's a really gentle, nice guy. And I think the book is a reflection of his personality as well. He taught me, or that book taught me, about empathy. You know, I thought Vince wrote that brilliantly, and had obviously got deep inside a very, very complex, self-destructive character, where, you know, there was almost like I thought he captured the child, the damaged child, really well. I thought it was a brilliant book. It's one of my favorite books. And I just think, you know, when you do a co-write, you're not looking for support for your man or woman when you write about them. You're looking for understanding. You hope to generate understanding. And you can't do that, I think, without them having a certain degree of moral courage. So, you know, it was obvious that Paul committed to the process. You know, he was brutal on himself. And I found that, so I just before I did Gareth Thomas, I reread that, Paul's book again, because Gareth was my first co-write and, you know, storied rugby player, captain of Wales, British Lions, 100 caps, but had a huge and defining backstory. He's struggled with his sexuality. Now, and obviously suicidal thoughts and sometimes actions. And when I do a co-write, I have what I call my speed dating session. So I go and have a few pints, couple of pints with the guy, couple of hours probably, and it's just, you know, shooting the shit basically. But, you know, just trying to get a sense of who they are. But also, the one question I always ask is, why are you doing this? And I do turn down a few people, and if anyone says, well, you know, there's a massive check at the end of this, well, fine, you know, go and find someone else, mate. I'm not interested in that. And I try to talk to them about, look, when you do a book, when it's between those two hardback covers, there's a permanence to it. You know, it's not immortality, it's a bit too florid, but it certainly is, like with Cookie, Alistair Cook, you know, great cricketer, fantastic sportsman. He didn't really think he was anything special. But I said, well, look, you know, if we do this book properly, it will be the reference point for your grandchildren and even your grandchildren's children, because that will be who, you know, Grandad Alistair was and is. And he got that. And so then he began, and he was probably the hardest to actually prize open. But with Gareth, you know, he really committed to it. And you know, we did some pretty powerful things. You know, we were in tears, you know, a lot together. We had a week round his mum and dad's house. His mum came in one day. We were lying on the floor, and I'm quite a big bloke, and obviously Gareth's a big lad. And we're lying on the floor and looking at one another. And Gareth had just showed me, it was a text from his ex-wife. And it was in the form of a song. And the lyrics were so pertinent to their story, because the key question for Gareth was, look, if you'd had a child, because his wife miscarried several times, if you'd have had a child, would you come out? And he said no. But so anyway, this DVD of this singer, he just burst into tears, and he burst into tears. So I burst into tears as well. And so if you picture the scene, right, the door opens and his mum pops her head around, and she says, she looks at us and we go, woo, cup of tea, boys. So she disappears, you know, and it was just like, oh wow, you know that. And so that's a really powerful thing. But that on that particular sort of section, there was one day where it was really mind blowing. Really, we spent the morning in the graveyard of a village church where he used to, when it was dark, he lived close by. He used to go into the graveyard and shout and scream at the walls of the church, you know, why God, why me, why are you pushing me, what do you want from me? And we were sitting, it was sort of drizzling, and we were sitting on this like sort of park bench, and it must look bizarre because like there were these sort of old biddies walking by, and I've got my tape and I've got it up to his mouth, and we're chatting away. And I'm thinking, well, what are they thinking of us? But at that stage, Gareth was saying, well, I wanted to be in that particular grave. I imagined myself in that particular grave with, you know, and you know, it was inscribed. You know, I can't remember the name of the deceased, but it was pretty profound. So then we said, right, okay, we're going down the coast, and we drove about 5-6 miles down the coast into the Bristol Channel. And this is where he's going to jump to his death. So we parked up in a farmyard and walked for about a mile and a half across these fields towards the promontory where he was going to jump. And I, you know, the idea was I wanted to recreate it and recreate the emotions of it. And so he said, well, I got to this point, we got to near the cliff top, and it was an onshore breeze. So it sort of hollowed out like a little square where he lay, and that on that particular morning, his clothes off apart from his pants. And he just lay there for 20 minutes contemplating essentially the end of his life. And so I said, right, okay, we'll do that. And we kept our gear on, thank God. But it was really powerful. And I said, just something made me ask. I said, where were you going to jump from? And he said, oh, actually, it was just down there. And he pointed about, I suppose, about 5-6 meters away. And there was a, right on the edge, there was a rock about a meter square, something like that. And I just said, impulsively, I said, right, let's go and stand on it. And there's a drop of about 250 feet. And it was bizarre because we did so. And I had my tape up next to him. You know, and as I said, it was, you know, the prevailing wind was onshore. So when we finished, you could barely make out anything we said to one another. But the weird thing was, we had complete, both of us had complete recall about what we said. It was one of those, you know, weird moments. And, you know, Gareth said then, Gareth, we took actually the only selfie between, you know, both of us, because I'm bloody useless at technology, and he got over my phone. And so we did the photograph. It's the only one we took together. I've still got it on the phone. And, on the way back, he was saying, that's it, that's closure. I'm never going to go back there again. I needed to do that. And I thought, yeah, but what have I put you through? And that night, we were back at his mum and dad's house, and his dad used to watch TV on this sort of lounge, this leather lounger. And I saw him, and he looked grey. Absolutely grey. Sort of parchment. His face had this sort of parchment quality. And the following morning, I asked his then partner, Ian, I said, what was he like? And he said, well, he didn't sleep. I know that he said he was just, you know, spaced. And I said to Gareth then, I said, look, mate, if I've pushed you too far, you've got to tell me. And he said, fine, no, it's okay. I'll be all right. I need you to do it. And that's, I suppose, where the responsibility of being a co-writer comes in. How far do you push your man or your woman to actually get what you want? Because I'm not daft. I know that was going to be a absolutely massively powerful element of the book.
Was there any guilt on your part driving back in the car?
No. Actually, driving back with him, there was. It wasn't guilt. It was concern, I think, rather than guilt. And it is, as I say, it's such an intimate process if you do it right. And I suspect it was, you know, going back to Vincent and Paul, I suspect it was a similar type of relationship. I don't know. I've never asked Vince about it, funny enough. But when the final chapter of that book, I didn't tell him about. And it was an open letter from him as a 40-year-old gay man to him as a 16-year-old guy who was unsure of his sexuality and certainly how that would play out publicly. And so I wrote this, and I knew him so well. And so this thing just flowed out. And that was the end of the book. That was the final chapter of the book. And it was the last chapter I saw him. So rather than bang it over an email, I said, well, it was just sort of just getting in the summer. I said, well, look, I'll come over, I'll have a glass of wine, and, you know, I'll show you it, and I'll bring you a hard copy. So I did that, and, you know, so I'm on the patio getting rid of my Chardonnay, whatever it was, and he comes barreling out of the house and grabs me in a bear hug, and he starts sobbing, and he doesn't stop sobbing for like 5 minutes. It was just, and, you know, the weird thing was, I thought, yeah, I've got him. I've absolutely got him. And that, funny enough, was a really sort of, that was a fulfilling moment. And also the other fulfilling part about that, and, you know, it's why I ask people to go the extra mile. It's like, you know, Jerry, when I did Jerry Barton, I said, right, one of my preconditions for doing this book with you is we go to prison together, because I want to be with you when you're in that environment, because that'll tell me a lot about you. But with Gareth, you know, we said, and funny enough, there was the same sense of purpose in the book I did with Dylan Hartley, where, you know, over time, you know, rugby's such a brutal sport. It was eating him alive. You know, he gave me his medical records, his full medical records, and it was horrendous. Horrendous. You know, couldn't go to the toilet after matches, you know, couldn't sit properly. You couldn't wipe his own backside. Concussion issues. And we wrote that book because we wanted to highlight the concussion debate in rugby, which I think it did, coming out as it did. But going back to Gareth, when we were, and this sounds really trite talking about it now in isolation, but yeah, when we were going through some of those days, we actually said, well, look, if we get this right, we could save someone's life. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous, but, you know, blimey, it did transpire that actually happened, because we did a speaking tour after when the book was published. And almost on a nightly basis, people were coming up and sharing their deepest stories. You know, we had one guy come up. We did a gig in a church in Bath. It actually was a doozy this night, because there were two incidents. The first one was a guy been waiting, because, you know, at the end of it, you do the line, you sign the book and all that. It was a guy who was waiting to have his book signed. He got there, and as soon as he got there, he just grabbed Gareth and said, look, I've got to ask you this question. What did you see when you were contemplating jumping off that cliff? And he said, well, and Gareth said, well, to be honest, I saw my mum and dad around my grave weeping. And this guy said, yeah, I saw my kids. I went to Weston-super-Mare. And with that, he went. He went so quickly, he forgot his book. Right? And I ran after him to give him his book. And we said afterwards, blimey, he hadn't told anyone that. He'd obviously not told anyone. And that was quite profound. And on that same night, there was a lady who was in the front row, on the front row of pews. And she couldn't take her eyes off Gareth. And again, she was in the queue at the end, and she grabbed him as well and started like howling, sobbing. And Gareth sort of looked over her shoulder towards me and went, get in. You know, so I've got her as well. And that's when you feel another human being just sobbing so much in your arms, it really, you know, has a huge effect on you. But anyway, her story was that she'd undergone gender change, and she was wearing a Wales rugby top, and she was talking about it, and she broke down because she said, I was a great disappointment to my mother because she wanted me to play rugby for Wales. Yeah. as a man, as a boy. And, you know, well, how do you rationalize that? But she found some strength by reading the book. And that really was really profound for me, I think.
When you were first thinking about breaking into sports writing, and there's a lovely scene in the book when you're in hospital and you decide you have to work in at least football, did you ever think like it could be that powerful?
No, at that stage it was a ball game, wasn't it? It was a dream, and you know, I suppose, you know, that's the beauty of innocence, isn't it? You know, that you don't really understand the parameters of the world in which you can be launched. You know, as I said, you know, I've been ludicrously lucky that for someone like me, from my background, council house kid from Watford, to have worked in more than 80 countries all over the world, and seen so much, is a really, you know, I'd say I'm blessed for that. But Yeah, it's game. We all start off with, we start off by loving the game, don't we? And then I soon, there was a pivotal moment for me when I was 11, when I was a ball boy at Watford. And, you know, we changed next to the, you know, I tell the story quite a lot, but we changed next to the home dressing room in this sort of laundry room. There's a lady called Molly Rush who looked after us, and she brought her Alsatian Sabre to every game. And we're in that room and it smelt like football, mud, stale sweat, bit of soap powder, liniment, because the smell of liniment from next door came through. We could hear the crowd through the fan light. When I got out, you just see these thousands of people, and it's a common, you know, it's common, you know, like Arthur Hopcroft, who's the football man, the book, probably the pivotal book that I read as a kid, you know, talked about football as working class communion. And I thought, yeah, you know, that I'd not read it at that time. I was only 11, but that figures now, because Watford played in this game, FA Cup's quarterfinal against Liverpool. They won 1-0. Shankly broke up his first great Liverpool team because of it. And there's a photograph in the book of the scorer of this goal, was a guy called Barry Endine. They got pub team for 50 quid. And, you know, great story and all that. But the photograph captures him turning behind the goal. And so behind him is the crowd. And I think the caption says, look, you know, look at that. You know, it's the Barry Davis line. Look at their faces. Just look at their faces. And the place was going nuts. And I'm on the touchline and I'm looking around. I'm seeing people hanging off the stand. And I thought, wow, I've got to be involved in this, because that was the moment where I thought, blimey, you know, this is unreal. This is powerful stuff, because it actually means so much to people. And I suppose that was the great lesson of that day. And it's one I've never forgotten. It means a lot. That's why I hate all these sort of, you know, vultures who are hovering over football at the moment.
Mm. And when you talk about the book being part manifesto, it seems to me that you're trying to reconcile that with what the game has become. Like you mentioned, it was all captured in the Super League. Like that was the microcosm of all that modern football has become. Has there been any reconciliation now, or do you look back at that time, at that cup upset against Liverpool, as a time that is irrevocably lost?
I don't think it's lost, because the feeling you can get the same feeling from the game. You know, there are some feelings where you're there, and off the top of my head, I don't know. Actually, I remember being at Chelsea when they were beaten by Bradford, and I thought, wow, in a cup, that's ridiculous, you know. And I love that. I love that unpredictability. Someone said to me after reading the book, is, you know, what strikes me is that you're more comfortable writing about, you know, a beggar in Mali or Bury AFC or lower league football than maybe you are doing the big stuff, the big picture stuff, like, you know, politics and Super League politics and everything else and Super Leagues. And I suppose, you know, he did have a point to a degree, that I love, you know, there's an accessibility and an intimacy about lower league football I really like. Would I work in the Super League? Yeah, probably. But, you know, you can't, you know, I sounded pious earlier on, but, you know, frankly, I'm not into self-delusion. I think I probably would. Because you have to, because it's the biggest game, and it's literally the biggest game in town. Would I enjoy it? Maybe not. Would I feel enthused by it? Probably not. I think that part of the process of the pandemic, you know, as we said earlier on, is the fact that there is that search for meaning and a bit more, I don't know, authenticity, maybe. And, I think what will happen post-pandemic is that a lot of people won't go back to the Premier League. They'll still sell out, because it's a tourist industry now. It's not a sport in institution. You know, you go to games now, the stadium are pretty much identical. They're pretty soulless. I love being in old football stadia when there's no one there, because there is someone there. There are people there. There are spirits there. There are ghosts there. You know, physically, you know, every ground that you go to, there will be, the ashes will have been spread on, over the pitch. I know I'm getting a bit sort of left field here, but there is something, I think, about the spirit of the game, and I think people will identify that. I think it's also tied up with the economics, because I've got a mate who is a West, you know, big West Ham fan, and he was saying the other day, you know, to take my lad to football, train down to London, a few beers beforehand, maybe a bite to eat, a couple of beers after the game. That's £250, £250. Now, he just moved, as it happened, and he said, there's a little non-league team down the road from me. It's £7 or £8 a game. I have a few pints with my mates. I can change ends at half-time if I want. You know, be home by 6 o'clock. You know, jobs are good. Mm. Why do I need to go down to London and the stadium I despise to watch my team? Because I watch my team on television anyway. So I think there might be a bit of that going on. I just think, you know, there's a Bielsa quote that I won't reproduce because I can't remember it at the moment, but it was along the lines of, look, if you want to understand English football, go and watch a lower league game. And I'm fully on board with that.
Can I briefly pull that, because you mentioned Liverpool, it just triggered in my mind, one of the scenes in the book was when you ended up around a table with Margaret Thatcher the day after the Highsell Stadium disaster.
Yeah, 2 days, yeah. 2 days.
Yeah. Can I ask you just to take us inside that room? Because I'm interested in, so what you, like the, what you talked about Gareth there, and the thread throughout this conversation is how sports writing can humanize people. Whereas I read that scene of you around the table with Thatcher, and Thatcher and the media who went along with her, the aim was to dehumanize people and dehumanize football supporters to ultimately a tragic, tragic crescendo.
Yeah, yeah. There was a terrifying certainty about her. And it also taught me about the application of power. And, you know, the imposition of falsehoods as well. You know, we were in the first floor room overlooking Downing Street. People mahogany table, were 9 of us. I wasn't at Heysel. Don Saunders, who was then the chief sports writer, and Colin Gibson, who would become an esteemed sports editor in his day. England were going on to a pre-World Cup trip to Mexico, so I was the guy at home, and I got drafted in as the Telegraph's representative. So there were 9 of us around the table, and she went round of us one by one and asked us what we do about hooliganism. And the terrifying thing about it was that she'd already made her mind up. You know, I could have spoken to her in Urdu, and she would have accepted everything that I said ostensibly. What struck me, one was, and again, I suppose I think to write, you've got to be a pretty committed people watcher. And I was fascinated by her. Her eyes were amazing. They just locked onto you. And, like a sort of a hawk. And as I said, I could have said anything. It didn't really matter what I said, because she'd already made her mind up. And that resulted that, you know, football fans were second class citizens. And even now, when you think in the pandemic, you know, the government, our government in the UK, their first instinct was to, do a bit of moral blackmail and talk about, and treat young footballers as sort of wastrels, multimillionaire wastrels. Well, actually, when you think about it, there's a new spirit of activism amongst our footballers, Raheem Sterling, but obviously most conspicuously Marcus Rashford. And Marcus Rashford's been the most convincing, empathetic political voice in this country, in my country, over the last 15, 18 months. You know, he's been really, mm. he, he is the epitome of what our politicians should be and have conspicuously failed to be. So even now, Thatcher's children or even Thatcher's grandchildren are in power. They still have that view that, you know, well, football is a bit Neanderthal. These people shouldn't be trusted. They shouldn't, you know, look at them. You know, they're an affront to common decency. Well, actually, chaps, they're not. I spent a year at Millwall, so I can, you know, I was embedded at Millwall for a book called Family, which I loved. And that was probably my finishing school in terms of my football education. You know, being in a dressing room for a year at a club like that was just amazing. I know there are a few desperados out there, I think you know, there's an awful lot of good people in football, and that's part of what you know. The sort of latter third of the book, I try and highlight that. That the good people doing great things in, you know, what is essentially actually to quote Gareth Southgate, you know, football is a great game, but a shitty industry. And it is, it's a people business, which burns people for fun.
The book is out now. Whose game is it anyway? I don't know what's next on the horizon for you.
No, I'm really going off piste. Actually, I'm going into a completely different genre. I can't talk too much about it at the moment. The deal's been done, but I'm working outside sport, and I'm working with probably the bravest man I've ever met, and I'll just leave it at this, that he is a severely disabled former Special Forces soldier. So I'm going to start writing that next week. You know, we've done loads and loads of interviews and we've wept a bit as well. You know, I think this one is basically will be Gareth on steroids. but again, you know, it's a different genre, but I'm trying to do the same thing. There is also, I've got a football idea that, again, it's a bit different, that might happen. But the book that I'm just about to start writing is due out. It's not been announced yet, but it's due out in April next year.
Super. We look forward to it. Mike Calvin, thanks so much for your time today. That was fantastic.
That's a pleasure. No problem.
Thank you very much to Michael Calvin. As we said at the top, his latest book, Whose Game Is It Anyway, is published by Pitch Publishing and is available now. Thank you so much for listening to the show and supporting us and the 42 as a whole. You can get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm @gcooney93. Or if you want to get in on the conversation around the show, chat about the episode, submit questions for future guests and trade reading recommendations with like-minded listeners, then just join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. That is it for this week. We are back next week with another great guest here on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.